Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Dan Bishop wins the special GOP 9th District primary handily. Now the race is on to September. The woman who ran the state elections board and who spearheaded the investigation into election fraud in the 9th is ousted. Charlotte's Catholic Diocese decides to release the names of clergy credibly accused of child sexual abuse, though not immediately, and Charlotte is getting a new bridge. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories, and those reporters include Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Katie Peralta is here from the Charlotte Observer. Hello, hello.
Good morning.
Nick Oxner joins us from WBTV News. Thanks for being back.
Howdy.
Warning, he is in the same room with Joe Bruno, a reporter for WSOC-TV Eyewitness News, but don't worry, Joe, Nick is on your side.
Absolutely. Good morning.
You know we went to college together.
Did you really? I didn't know that.
Yep.
I'll be darned. Well, there you go. Okay, we begin today with the Daily Double. This was an actual clue on a recent episode of Jeopardy, as seen on Joe Bruno's Twitter feed. A new contest was ordered in 2019 due to election fraud in the 9th Congressional District in this southern state. Joe, you buzzed in first. What's the answer?
What is North Carolina?
What is North Carolina, indeed? So, how much was the correct answer worth to that question?
You know, I actually didn't see it. It was tweeted to me.
Okay.
But between this and being featured in the season finale of Veep, Charlotte really has made it.
Really? Okay. We were in the Veep season finale?
Oh, yeah. What convention.
Okay. It's a little early. Are they on the air next year, Veep?
No.
Okay.
Oh, that's the series finale.
Okay, well, the GOP 9th district primary was decided this week, and State Senator Dan Bishop was the runaway winner, nearly 48% of the vote. Steve, you're our political reporter. Bishop was always the front runner, but did we expect him to be so far ahead of the pack and so much ahead of that 31% that you needed to win without a runoff?
No, I don't think so. And I think a lot of the people at his victory party were pretty surprised, too, that he almost hit 50%. I mean, he won all 8 counties in the district. He was second in Union County, right, which is Stoney Rushing's home turf, so he did very well there.
Oh, he won Union.
He won Union County.
He won Union. Yeah, that's right. I'm sorry. You're right.
Is he more significant?
Yes.
Yes.
And so, right, he cleaned up across the board, and I think there was kind of a sense that when the race came down to the end, just people kind of coalesced around him as the person with the fundraising ability, the experience, the resume to take on Dan McCready.
So I know you're going to answer all of the above, but I'm going to ask the question anyway because people need to hear the answer. What led to Bishop's victory? Was it name recognition because he's a state senator, so people know him from that? His TV ads where he surrounded himself with knockdown clowns with pictures of Democrats plastered on their faces, the notoriety of his authorship of HB2, or something else?
I would say all of those.
All of the above. I knew that's what you're going to say.
You know, I think at his election party, I talked to Dan Barry. He's the in Union County, the former GOP chair, and he said that you know, he felt like a lot of voters look to Dan Bishop as someone who's been in the trenches with them, fighting really tough fights. Of course, that would go back to HB2, and that he was someone who I think people felt gave him their best chance. And there's been, I think, a sense among a lot of Republicans that Mark Harris did not attack or challenge Dan McCready sufficiently, and they feel like Dan Bishop is going to be able to do that and press him and be more aggressive and try and pin him down. There's a real frustration in the Republicans that Dan McCready, you know, you could say, well, he doesn't answer a lot of specifics, or you could say in his defense, he's just very disciplined, right? They think Dan Bishop's going to be able to to really get after it.
Bishop really relishes fighting. I mean, he really relishes debating with people. I moderated a candidate's forum when he was taking some jabs from some of his primary opponents, mm-hmm. and he almost got like a smirk on his face when he got to answer. And I think that's, you know, what people, to Steve's point, won.
Well, he won all 8 of the counties in the 9th district, including Union County, as you mentioned, which had Stoney Rushing, who was the second place finisher. Does this seal the deal, do you think? This is a Republican district primarily. Does this seal the deal for Bishop over McCready, or does McCready have a shot at this?
He has to raise some money. He's significant.
Who?
Bishop has to raise some money. McCready has a heavy advantage in fundraising right now. But this is a Trump plus 12 district, and McCready is the one who really will have his work cut out for him.
Is he up to it?
There's going to be a lot of national interest. He says he's ready for the fight. A lot of different groups are going to be helping him, and they're also going to be helping Bishop as well.
So this is the summer of Dan. It's Dan squared, Dan Bishop and Dan McCready, Republican versus Democrat. And the day after the election victory, Dan Bishop kicked the next 2 months off, or 3 months, whatever it is, between now and September, by standing outside of Dan McCready's headquarters with a cardboard cutout of McCready, life-size, in the background.
The voters of the 9th District need to know what they're getting in their next congressman. I'm the right Dan.
Did he say why he's the right Dan?
I think it's in not, general, huh? Well, I don't remember.
Really, he said why the other guy was the wrong Dan.
And it's just, you know, again, it goes back to his kind of catchphrase, crazy liberal clown. Try and say that fast. Crazy liberal clowns is his. That's what he says again and again.
This just shows you how aggressive Bishop is. I mean, he literally brought his campaign to McCready's campaign headquarters, held a press conference 30 minutes before McCready was supposed to do the same thing 30 steps away.
So this sets the campaign up for the tone of the campaign going forward, clearly.
And shows their strategy, because really what Bishop did in that press conference was post three questions on three hot-button conservative pressure points for Dan McCready to answer that are really no-win questions. Quite frankly, either if he doesn't answer them, it looks like, oh, he's Dan McCready and he won't take a position. If he answers them truthfully, well, they, you know, might.
What were the questions?
Will you run for U.S. Senate? Will you pledge not to run for U.S. Senate in 2020? And it took him about five or six tries before we finally got McCready to say he's not interested, but he still didn't pledge not to run.
And I was surprised by that. Like, when I saw the three questions, what was the other one? Green New Deal, right?
The other question was, does he support President Trump's border wall? Where does he stand on immigration?
Will you back the nominee?
Mm-hmm. And McCready did not take a position on who he's endorsing for the 2020 Democratic nominee.
Why would he at this stage?
You know, if he goes out and says, hey, I'll back the nominee, then Bishop's ads are all McCready will support Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren. And
well, McCready did say, if I'm not mistaken, that he does not support the Green New Deal.
Correct. He also does not support Medicare for all, he said, or impeaching President Trump.
And what was the first question? The
first question was 2020 Senate.
Isn't Dan Bishop the one that's more likely to run for senator against Tom Tillis than Dan McCready would be putting himself up as a first-termer?
I actually don't think so. I think McCready would be more likely to run for Senate just because they don't have a top-of-the-ticket candidate who is well-known across the state.
Okay. When Bishop was talking in the cut we played a minute ago, he was referring back to Dan McCready not taking very many stands in the previous election against Mark Harris, because he used a slogan a lot, country over party, in that election, as opposed to really talking about key policy points. Dan Bishop said, wrong Dan McCready went through two elections without telling anyone where he stood on anything. What two elections?
The primary versus Christian Cano. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. And then on Tuesday night, McCready issued a statement saying he's fighting for everyone in the district who deserves lower health care costs, great public schools, and secure Medicare. Is that more than he said before?
No, but I think it sticks to kind of the themes that nationally the Democrats in Congress are trying to hit and play up, certainly health care. And we hear Nancy Pelosi hammering away on health care every day. I do think that Dan McCready had more specific answers at his press conference than what we've seen previously, like on Green New Deal, like on impeachment. He was clearly prepared to answer some of these policy specifics where I think at least some people would have not expected that. I also think in terms of answering questions from reporters, he was prepared with more specifics than Dan Bishop was. Dan Bishop went to his press conference, asked his three prepared questions, and then largely, was it you, Joe, who tried to get him to talk about HB2, and he wouldn't give a straight answer?
Yeah, the question I had was whether, given all of the economic backlash that we saw from HB2, whether he regrets authoring that bill, and we asked him three times, and we didn't get a clear answer.
I was just going to say, he did say he was on Morning Edition yesterday, and Bishop did say kind of, he said it wasn't perfect, which is the most I've seen him give on that really in 3 years. And, you know, and that statement you read, Mike, from McCready about schools, healthcare, it did not mention HB2. Now,
right.
McCready did mention it in his fundraising email, but I'll be curious to see just how much over the next 4 months
he
goes
still
there.
Kind of tends to doubt the economic impact portion of this story. On Morning Edition, he was saying, you know, the AP estimate of 3.7 whatever billion, you know, that's based on a bunch of reporters. These aren't economists. And he pointed out that PayPal, this is true, like they didn't name where they are expanding. And that was an economic impact of like $200 million a year.
Well, you wrote about this week, or you tweeted about it this week, Katie, about the economic impact. And it's a lot more than people realize, I think. And it continues to this moment.
It continues to this moment. Charlotte's reputation is still so damaged that they're paying millions of dollars a year to market themselves because people still don't understand that Charlotte, you know, was taking a more progressive stand from the get-go.
I mean, six states have banned travel of their employees, state employees, to Charlotte for events and conventions and things like that.
Correct.
Because of HB2 and because they're not happy with the bill that replaced HB2.
Correct. And in the interview yesterday, Bishop was talking about specifically PayPal. Obviously, that was like the first ball to drop, I guess. But there were countless others. I mean, I feel like we all reported on this till our faces went blue in 2016.
Well, that's it, because you are the problem. You and the media are the problem. Dan Bishop has said several times that it is the media that is consumed with HB2 and a need to keep dredging it up. He said that HB2 is an old issue and there is a lot of fantasy about it in the media. I think he said voters are tired of hearing about it. Is it the media that keeps focusing on this? Have voters moved beyond this? Should they move beyond this? Should we move beyond this?
If he means voters have moved beyond it, then he wants to move beyond it, clearly. I think this is going to become a talking point again, very prominently in the next several months.
And is the media to blame for things that don't go right that people do in politics?
No, it is if you're running as a Republican in the age of Trump. I mean, it's talking points right out of Donald Trump. And that's not
that was my point, and I didn't want to say it, so I'm glad you said it.
It's not an ideological position. That's a statement of fact. But and it's interesting to me that Bishop isn't just giving this two-armed embrace of HB2 because the district is largely rural and largely conservative. And so Dan Bishop has an issue profile and a track record as a right-leaning conservative, he fits better with the district. That's why Dan McCready's trying to moderate himself a little bit.
And I'm not sure Dan Bishop's HB2 problems extend past Mecklenburg County. I can tell you nobody in Bladen County brought up HB2 on Election Day, and I'd be willing to bet Robeson or Richmond counties are the same way.
And his Senate district, as his campaign's pointed out a couple times this week, his state Senate district now overlaps the portion of Mecklenburg County almost identically to the portion of the 9th District that's in Mecklenburg County.
Ah.
And he's the only Republican to be reelected to the General Assembly from Mecklenburg County.
Yep. In his campaign television commercials, Dan Bishop had that famous and well-done commercial of him standing amidst all these clowns that you would normally punch and they'd come back up, and they had faces of Democrats, prominent Democrats, and many of them, most of them, national Democrats as opposed to Dan McCready Democrat. He also talked about the Democrats' agenda of socialism, open borders, infanticide, 90% tax rates. I think the last time we had 90% tax rate was Eisenhower was president. He's a Republican. Having prison inmates vote. First of all, is that what Democrats stand for? And secondly, will that play beyond the GOP base? Maybe we'll have to get an answer to that after we come back from the break, because clearly we're going to one. I can hear the orchestra playing in the background. It's the local news roundup. Steve Harrison is here from WFAE News, Katie Peralta from The Observer, Joe Bruno from Channel 9, and Nick Oxner from WBTV. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Nick Oxner from WBTV, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, Katie Peralta from The Observer, and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. So Dan Bishop has talked a lot about Democrats being socialists, wanting open borders, supporting infanticide. That's an allusion to the abortion situation. 90% tax rates. I've never heard a Democrat say that, but okay. Having prison inmates vote. is this credible? Is this something that will play beyond the GOP base?
Well, these are all things that someone with a D next to their name have said, right? They're all references to things that, be it a presidential candidate, a Democratic presidential candidate has proposed or put forward. And
90% tax rate?
I don't know who said that one, but I'm sure someone said it.
I think it was like there was some talk about maybe AOC was talking about going up to 70,
so. Sure.
And then someone maybe chimed in and said, or even higher. I tried to Google 90% to find that out and had trouble with it, but there was a lot of talk about 70.
These are. I mean, you ask about the GOP base. That's exactly who the talking points are designed to appeal to. I mean, that's their and that is largely, again, even if you're not registered as a Republican in the 9th district, you know, you're likely to have to be conservative or conservative-minded old Jessecrats.
Okay.
And so that's their design.
So the afternoon after Bishop made his comments in front of Dan McCready's headquarters, McCready accused Bishop of trolling him. Is that because he did the news conference in front of his headquarters or something else going on?
No, that was just in response to the location.
He also brought up what Democrats hope will be Bishop's Achilles heel, that's HB2, and positioning that as a warning to what would happen if Bishop goes to Washington.
Senator Bishop's agenda is the one thing that everybody in North Carolina should be afraid of.
He called it quite possibly the worst that North Carolina has ever seen. It's a Republican district. Is that a wise thing to say?
The other thing you have to keep in mind is Bishop has had two elections, the primary and his general, where the candidates that he ran against ran on HB2. But Bishop was the author of this, and Bishop won handily on both races.
And will that be enough to motivate Democrats? A comment like that from Dan McCready, that the agenda that Dan Bishop brings with him to Washington if he goes is a dangerous agenda and the worst ever. Will that be enough to get Democrats who may be laissez-faire, and it's not an election year normally, and it's certainly September's not election month normally, they have to go to the polls. Will that get them to go to the polls to stave off this invasion of conservative thought?
Between HB2 and the Charlotte City Council Democratic at-large primary, I don't think he'll have any issues getting Democrats in Mecklenburg County to the polls.
Primary in September, though?
It's the same day.
Same day.
It's just Union through Bladen is where he's going to have to pick up some steam on Bishop.
So if Dan McCready were to take somehow Mecklenburg County, could he win the 9th without taking the other 7 counties?
He would have to cut into Union because Union's going to go to Bishop strongly.
So Dan Barry, the former chair of the Union County Republican Party, said of Bishop that he had been a staunch voice for the conservatives in North Carolina. He stood in the breach. He stared down the radical left coming out of California with the Human Rights Campaign. But can Dan McCready be painted with that radical left brush?
I think McCready is doing a good job so far at distancing himself from the radical left. I think he's being, you know, as middle of the road as possible. At least that's the way he got off to with his first press conference.
Well, but then the problem for Dan McCready is you have situations like what erupted with the contribution from Representative Ilhan Omar, right? He took a campaign contribution from her in the 2018 general election. I think it was Bishop's campaign pointed this out. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm returning this because I don't support you. She's accused of making anti-Semitic statements and has been one of the more controversial freshman Democratic members of the U.S. House. And so he returned the contribution and said, I don't support what she said. Well, that prompted backlash from Democrats saying, how dare you abandon her? And so he's kind of in a darned if you do, darned if you don't situation on some of these things.
And I think this is a little bit of the same thing could be a play with HB2, because if you bash Dan Bishop on HB2, I think, you know, a fair question that Bishop would ask him is, well, would you have voted for the city council ordinance? Mm-hmm. Do you support that? And because, you know, there were pieces of that that were really controversial, will be incredibly controversial in the 9th. So what is his answer?
So Dan Bishop is a very different candidate than Mark Harris. It was kind of a gentlemanly contest the last time around, in spite of voter fraud, or election fraud, rather. And McCready lost to Mark Harris, in a squeaker of an election. What kind of a campaign will he have to run successfully, or to have the same kind of finish against Dan Bishop?
He's clearly going to have to be more of an issues-based candidate, because Dan Bishop is not going to allow McCready to continuously say country over party for tough questions.
And he's got to be aggressive. The last time he could take that middle-of-the-road moderate stance, that's not going to work against Dan Bishop. And again, Dan Bishop is a guy who likes to get dirty and challenge his opponents. And, you know, I think this will be very expensive, and I think it's going to be far more confrontational.
Fewer than 10% of eligible voters voted in this special primary. It's an odd non-election year primary, but it followed that scandal that left a Republican winner out in the dust with an election that was overturned. Why wasn't that enough to boost Republican turnout so that more than 10% of Republican voters came and voted for the winner?
You can't say that the media didn't cover it. I mean, we've been covering the primary like every single day pretty much. I don't understand why turnout was so low. I don't think it had to do with the scandals, though.
Hmm. And Mecklenburg did well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mecklenburg
yes.
outperformed the district, I think.
Okay. Well, yesterday at 12:53 p.m., President Trump sent out this tweet. Quote, congratulations to Dan Bishop on his big Republican primary victory in the 9th Congressional District of North Carolina. Dan is strong on crime, loves our military, vets, 2A. What is 2A?
Second Amendment. Guns. Okay.
Oh, Second Amendment. And great health care. He has my complete capitalized and total capitalized endorsement capitalized. Hashtag MAGA. So that's where we'll leave the 9th District for a moment at least. Let's see here. In the same week that the GOP's 9th District contest was redone, the Board of Elections, which ordered that new election, voted 3-2 to replace their executive director. Is it Kim Strach? Is that how you say your last name? Strach? Strach, who led the board's investigation into the absentee mail ballot fraud in Bladen County. Why this decision now?
Because this is about the earliest time that the now Democrat-controlled board could make this change. I mean, this is politics, is what happens in North Carolina. Kim Strach was hired roughly six years ago when the Republicans took control because the governor gets to appoint the board, and so it's a majority of the party of the governor. And so they fired longtime Democrat registered director Gary Bartlett when the Republicans took control and replaced him with Kim Strach. And so Democrats had wanted to replace Strach for a while, and they couldn't first because of legal reasons, and they went to court to overturn laws that blocked them from appointing a new director. And then when those court cases were resolved, we were right in the middle of the 9th District thing. So I think this is the earliest the board members felt.
And the official reason, the party line, is that Kim Strach is a great investigator. She did a fantastic job of the 9th District, but we need someone who can administer elections and have a better relationship with the counties. That was the reason.
That's what Bob Cordell, the Democratic Elections Board chairman, said. They needed an election board executive director who could be more focused on administration.
You know, she grew up as an investigator in the state board, and that's her forte. And as I've said, she's really good at it. But we think Karen Brinson Bell is terrific as an administrator.
She's the new person they have appointed to the job, who takes over on June 1st. But Republican board member Ken Raymond, as you might imagine, does not buy Cordell's reasoning.
For us to make a major change like this in the top management of the Board of Elections, we need a very, very, very compelling reason, and I just don't see it.
And, of course, on the other side of that ping pong table is Democratic Governor Roy Cooper.
I think that this is something that a new board that's set up needs to make sure they have the staff that works for them.
So who is Karen Brinson Bell? She's the new person.
Yes, she she's going to be moving from Charleston, South Carolina, up to Raleigh, where she currently lives, to take the job. She worked as a state elections technician for the North Carolina Board of Elections for 5 years in the 2000s. Then she ran the Transylvania County Board of Elections for another 4 years after that. Then she left to go work for a company that sells election-related software for a couple years. And most recently, since 2016, has been working for a nonprofit group that promotes ranked choice voting that was founded and run by Gary Bartlett, the former Democrat elections director for the State Board of Elections, who Kim Strach replaced.
So Kim Strach, is she responsible? If the Democrats are saying she's a great investigator, not such a great administrator, was she responsible for recommending that this election be overturned through her investigation of what happened in Bladen and Robeson County?
It was largely her work that led to the board findings.
And the Democrats aren't happy with that?
I think they This goes back to the Democrats wanted their person.
Want their person in there.
This is why she's a political appointee. Elections have consequences.
So right? How will things change with an administrator by name Karen Brinson Bell in charge? Do we know?
We don't know, and she's been, I think, very deliberate about not saying a whole lot until she gets on the job, because Kim Strack is staying on the job through the end of May.
And as luck would have it, while that meeting was going on to make the decision to oust Kim Strack, a fire alarm went off, forcing the evacuation of everybody involved. A firefighter reported that the alarm sounded after someone put a pot pie in the toaster on the fifth floor. There's a lesson in that somewhere. I didn't know you could put a pot pie in a toaster, but okay.
Welcome to North Carolina politics and the State Board of Elections. There could not have been anything more appropriate to happen in that moment.
Okay. Among young people especially, vaping is now in vogue. It's causing concerns not unlike those over cigarette smoking decades ago. And now North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein has filed a lawsuit against one of the major manufacturers of vaping paraphernalia, Juul, alleging the company has caused addiction in consumers by deceptively downplaying the potency and danger of nicotine. Juul has also come under scrutiny by the Food and Drug Administration. Why this suit now, and what would its impact be if Josh Stein is successful?
I think the Attorney General wants to limit the amount of flavors that can be sold right now. Juul advertises in creme brulee flavor, I think cotton candy as well, all these sweet flavors that could be enticing to a teenager. So that's one of the things that he is looking for. But I think he also wants to really cut down on Juul's marketing, the way that it kind of hit the scene at first. You know, a lot of teenagers saw it. Many people thought that Juul was kind of advertising toward the younger crowd.
These e-cigarettes, if I'm not mistaken, I don't smoke them, so I don't know, but they are primarily a nicotine delivery device as opposed to a flavor delivery or an aroma delivery device, correct?
It's basically nicotine, but you get that creme brulee, that cotton candy. You can taste it.
So we know that cigarettes cause cancer. Is it the nicotine in the cigarettes that cause cancer, or is it the tar and other byproducts of ingesting smoke from burning tobacco that cause the cancer and the lung problems?
I think with Juul, the health risk is still up in the air. It's not 100% certain how dangerous these are. The main concern is the nicotine and getting young children hooked on nicotine at
How
such
young
an early
is young?
Age.
15, 14, 13, 12?
Seventh, eighth grade.
Okay. The FDA restricts the sales of fruit or candy flavors of these products in stores, but they allow menthol, tobacco, and mint flavors. North Carolina would take mint off the market here, in addition to popular flavors like mango and cucumber. And would prevent all customers in North Carolina from purchasing flavors online that aren't tobacco or menthol. So Stein says Juul's market practices have caused an epidemic among young people. How widely used are these?
They're very popular, very popular.
Do we know of any health effects that have been, what's the word I'm looking for, definitely attributed to?
They're so popular, but they're also still pretty new. I mean, we're talking
they are.
In the last 5 years at
least. But are there any cases that we can point to? Well, that was caused by over-smoking these products.
Nicotine addiction, I think, is what they are really pushing here.
Okay, because it is an addiction, and it is. All right, in recent weeks, we've seen southern states like Alabama pass restrictive abortion laws that would essentially outlaw any form of abortion. These laws apparently are designed to call the question of abortion before the Supreme Court in an effort to overturn Roe v. Wade. And earlier this year, a federal court struck down our state's ban on abortions after the 20th week of pregnancy. But another bill, the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, has stalled in our state legislature. What would that bill do?
It would basically instruct medical professionals to provide care for a newborn or fetus, whatever, who survive an abortion.
Do physicians not provide care for a fetus that might survive an abortion? Do they just let it die.
No, and that's something.
No what?
Or sorry, they do. They would provide care.
So why the need for this bill?
And I think that's the question that Governor Cooper has posed, because there are, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think there are already federal regulations in place that require physicians to do that. It doesn't spell it out specifically
in
North Carolina.
The oath would, their oath,
correct,
would require them to do that. What? Are there instances, do we know that this has happened, where physicians have said, well, I'm doing an abortion here and the fetus is alive, but I'm not going to save it?
And that's the other thing. I haven't heard of specific instances or data that point to this as being an ongoing problem. It seems like North Carolina joining in on this conversation to, you know, restrict abortion rights in whatever way that they can.
Mm-hmm.
And this is maybe just the first step for, you know, the GOP-run legislature.
So Governor Cooper vetoed this bill earlier this year after it passed the GOP-controlled legislature. The legislature can't override his veto now?
They're trying to do that right now.
The Senate has overridden the veto with the support of one Democrat who's come under immense scrutiny from his fellow Democrats for voting with the Republicans on this. It was set to be voted on. The veto override was set to go for a vote in the House this week, and that got yanked when other people found out about it at the last minute.
Okay. This week, the 46-county Catholic Diocese of Charlotte announced it will publish a list of clergy members who've been credibly accused of child sex abuse. Charlotte is one diocese that has been pretty slow to adopt this policy. Why did Bishop Jugas make this decision?
He's felt a lot of pressure from people within the diocese to do so. Survivors of priest abuse, for instance, have been very vocal about the need to be transparent with the list. And now Jugas is saying that they'll put out the list before the year's end.
But that they've been pretty vocal about that for quite a while. Why now?
They haven't committed. But keep in mind, just a couple weeks ago, the number two person in the diocese had to step aside because of allegations of credible sexual misconduct from the 70s. So people have been pushing for the diocese to be open and transparent right about this, and they haven't committed until now.
We'll come back to that topic in a moment. We'll also be talking about the closing of the streetcar and this new bridge we're going to get and more. Yes, there's a new bridge in your life coming soon to a highway near you. We'll talk about all those things when we come back with Joe Bruno, Nick Oxner, Katie Peralta, and Steve Harrison. It's the Local News Roundup on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the Local News Roundup. Steve Harrison is here from our newsroom, Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Observer, Nick Oxner from WBTV, and Joe Bruno from WSSC-TV. We're going back to talk about the Catholic Archdiocese and their decision to release the names of credibly accused clergy over the last several decades who have been accused of child sex abuse. Bishop Jugas says it's hard to predict how long the diocese's investigation will take, but that list should be published by the end of the year. Now, the Vatican just published a new policy on how all of this should be handled. Is this coincidence that this is happening now?
I think that's the driving force behind this change. I mean, it is significant. This is a significant policy reversal. All of the media outlets in Charlotte have been for really the past year doing a great job covering the issue of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church and specifically in the Charlotte Diocese. And this is an exact 180 from what their previous spokesman, David Haynes, who abruptly left after Father Mo, the number two in the diocese, was forced out. I mean, David Haynes has told me to my face that they think that naming priest abusers could be harmful to survivors. Of course, that's the opposite of what survivors we've talked about.
Of course, yeah.
And doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. And so this is absolutely a sea change. I think it's welcomed from the community of survivors and those who support them in Charlotte. But it also begs several questions. One, who's going to be deciding who is credibly accused and who's not credibly accused? And two, will the diocese do other things, take other steps to make public allegations from years gone by? There are troves of sealed records at the courthouse.
Why do you suppose this is so difficult for the Catholic Church to handle? These are people who are allegedly moral and allegedly ethical and should be able to clearly see right from wrong. Why is this so damn difficult?
It's a good question, and I'll start by saying it's not been difficult for Catholic leadership in other dioceses all across the country. Yeah. In the last couple of years, we've been talking about clergy sex abuse for how long now? Pre-sex abuse for how long? But in the last couple of years, we've started to see lists of credibly accused clergy, apologies from bishops, and things that we have not explicitly seen in the Charlotte diocese. But it is interesting in why the edict from the Pope, or the new policy from the Pope coming down, is so significant, because previously canon law actually suggested to canon law, the church law that priests follow and the church follows, suggested that people should kind of suggested a process that results in allegations of sexual abuse not always becoming public. Okay. And so what the Pope did was clarify canon law to say, no, this is something we should be.
And he clarified it to point out that people who have these accusations against priests share them with their local bishops or other members of the church higher up, not to police. And that's a major sticking point for a lot of survivors. And I'm curious, from a legal standpoint, doesn't it seem like you'd be obligated to inform law enforcement about something like that if you're breaking the law by abusing a child?
By a child, I think you'd be a mandatory reporter, I believe, in state law. But I think that's a sea change in the church, right, which changes very slowly and is generally resistant to change. I don't think anyone would argue that there is more to go.
So Charlotte attorney Seth Langston sued the diocese on behalf of abuse victims more than 10 years ago, and he gave this reaction to this decision, I think, to WBTV.
It validates the victims, that their accusations were taken seriously. It also encourages other survivors to come forward because, sexual abusers normally have, or usually have, many, many victims.
In other states, including Texas now, law enforcement has simply come into diocesan headquarters and taken papers and records and files. Is that something that this diocese is trying to avoid?
I'm sure it is. So Pennsylvania, I think, being the first state where the Attorney General released their investigative report, which shed a lot of light. In North Carolina, our Attorney General, Josh Stein, does not have the jurisdiction to go do something like that. Our Attorney General is...
Why not?
He's, by law, very limited in what an original jurisdiction and what kind of cases...
What about local law enforcement?
They could. They could. If someone were to make a report and they decided to investigate and the district attorney wanted to move forward.
So the new policy regarding child sex abuse issued by Pope Francis has been criticized for not requiring Catholic leaders to report abuse allegations to police. But if you release the names of people who have been credibly accused, won't police or criminal justice officials take action on those on the list who are still alive?
I think
this goes back to 1972.
Oh, absolutely. But I think the concern is for future cases, right? And should there be some affirmative duty to report sex abuse? Yeah, I think most people would say there should be. And we'll have to see how that plays out.
Okay. Well, if you want to ride Charlotte's streetcar, you better hurry up because you have until June 3rd, and then they're shutting it down for 18 months.
Construction is always painful, and we do appreciate the folks and the patience that they have shown.
That's David McDonald, the streetcar's project manager, talking to WSOC-TV. Why are they shutting the streetcar down, pray tell?
They have to elevate the platforms for the new streetcar to come on through.
Yes, and McDonald told Channel 9 that was always the plan, to shut down the streetcar, but that contractor mistakes forced them to close things sooner than planned. What mistakes?
Well, we're supposed to be driving across the Hawthorne Lane Bridge right by now, but we are not, and that we don't know when that will be. But because that happened, they've kind of reprioritized other portions of the project, and Katz claims that is why the streetcar is shutting down a little earlier than expected.
Nothing to do with the convention, the Republican convention?
Well, I mean, there's kind of two pieces to this. They're expanding the streetcar by 2.5 miles,
right?
And Katz has said they can't finish it on time because of the RNC. The chief executive said that he spoke with DHS and the RNC, and they told him, you can't work on it for 60 to 90 days, which seems like an incredibly long time. I talked to David McDonald, who we played the clip from. He's the project manager. He said, he hasn't spoken to anyone in the federal government. He said, 60 to 90 days, we use that estimate from the DNC 7 years ago. So it was kind of a mystery as to why the whole thing has to shut down for so long and could they work?
Well, the thing runs right past the convention location, and I know they're shutting down the Lynx Blue Line in that area too.
But they'll only shut down the Lynx during the convention,
right,
for like 4 days,
okay,
not 60 to 90.
So they're raising the platforms to accommodate these new vehicles, because when the streetcar comes back in 18 months, it'll have sleek, new, modern vehicles that look very much like the Lynx Blue Line cars. And they're also upgrading the power, because evidently those cars require more power. So wasn't it always the city's intention to have new, modern, sleek streetcars running on the streetcar line from the very beginning? Wasn't that always their intention?
Yes.
So why didn't they build the existing platforms and install the correct amount of power to the power lines to begin with, or just buy new, sleek cars to begin with and kick it off with new cars? Why didn't they do that?
I think that's a really good question.
Isn't this costing us more money?
It is. And the thing, the streetcar's been open now 4 years.
Right.
It will shut down for 18 months, maybe 20, maybe 21. If you go back in the history of the streetcar, the whole thing has been kind of rushed. It was this they didn't really have a plan. It was just like, let's build a little piece of it now, kind of get the camel under the tent, and then we can build another piece and another piece. And so now you have the situation where they spent, they built this first line that a lot of it has to be torn up again. And yeah, because there wasn't a lot of big vision planning on this.
So the streetcar stops running June the 3rd, but they're going to serve riders with buses.
That's right.
All along the same route, just that one little section from the hospital to the – is that what they're going to do?
Right. Yeah. It is.
Is it going to be a full bus or a jitney?
That's what they had before. They had a Gold Rush shuttle
that went
on the same route.
Are they going to use those Gold Rush shuttles? Do you know?
I don't know if they'll use those or some other vehicle.
The streetcar is free at the moment. Will the replacement of these shuttle buses be free too?
Yeah.
The shuttle buses will be free?
And when the new streetcar is up and running in 50 years, will they be free, or are they going to start charging for the streetcar?
They'll start charging for the streetcar when it comes back.
Ridership of the streetcar has been falling, but ridership for all transit has been falling in the city in recent years for whatever reason. Do we know why?
Part of it with the streetcar is...
it's free.
It's free. Part of it is a few years ago, you know, you had the rail, the streetcar to go from the hospital to the arena, and then you could get off at the arena and take that little bus we talked about to go to J.C. Smith.
Right.
So when they started building the second phase, they shut down the bus. So now you have the streetcar that only goes a mile and a half. It's just not really as useful anymore.
Right.
I think the other thing is, though, when you dump a bunch of scooters on uptown, like the scooter competes perfectly with the streetcar. It's just, you know, because you're going half a mile or a mile.
Well, you're making the case now for people who are anti-transit, because they're saying we don't even know what kind of transit options are going to be available in the future. And they point to self-driving cars mostly in that scenario. But these scooters are a great example of that.
Yes.
Although anyone who's lived in South End for 5 years can tell you that we have more and more cars on the road, and you got to get something to move all the people that are moving here. So.
Yeah, but they're not taking the streetcar, the train, because it only goes in one direction, two directions. It doesn't go in multiple directions, and that's the problem. Another bridge is coming, though, to help out with the traffic flow, because it's a pedestrian bridge, because everybody's going to be walking now. Over I-277, it's approved by the Charlotte City Council on Monday night. Where will this bridge be, and what will it connect?
It will connect the rail trail to Stonewall Station, which is over there by the new Whole Foods. So right now, as the rail trail exists, you can run.
Where does the rail trail terminate? In South End?
It terminates at that Camden apartment complex in South End, yes. So, and you're kind of just like abandoned there. You'll have to walk up some steps, and you have to cross the bridge and navigate through some traffic past Uptown Cabaret. It's a very difficult experience for a walker or riding a scooter.
Well, this
near impossible.
Well, that you bring up an interesting point. Well, will you be able to ride a scooter or a bike on this pedestrian bridge?
I would think so, yes.
This is a $1.2 million bridge. We haven't heard much about it. Why not?
Well, they're just starting the design phase for this bridge. I believe the $1.2 million was for design.
Oh, so that's just for that's not for the construction. That's just for the design.
Just
of the
for
bridge?
Design.
Okay.
I think the entire project's going to be close to $11 million, right?
Okay. Yes.
Coming from private and public.
So when does construction begin? When is it scheduled to end? How would this impact traffic?
I think it's going to take about a year to design the bridge.
Okay. And when they start constructing it, this will be impeding the flow of traffic on 277, one would presume?
I would probably think it would be similar to how they're how they were building the bridge over Independence Boulevard. I believe they had some closures overnight, and I'm sure that's the route they would take with 277.
Hopefully this one goes a little more smoothly.
Yes.
Okay, in a split vote on Tuesday night, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board approved an equity policy that aims to close the racial and economic disparities reflected in student achievement across the district. How will this policy accomplish that? I've stumped the panel. Where is Ann Doss Helms? District 6 member Sean Strain has served on the policy committee, and that's the committee that drew up this policy, and he voted against it on Tuesday night. He complained that it elevated socioeconomic diversity among all other goals. Why is that a problem?
I guess he would feel like that the main mission of CMS would be achievement, and that if you spend so much time focusing on balancing schools, making sure numbers are equal, that would get in the way of academic performance.
The Observer wrote an article this week that pointed out that whites make up 28% of all CMS students. That was a shocking figure to me. Only 28% of the student population is white. How should we feel about that? What does that say?
So it seems like there should be perhaps that's the driving force of this, is maybe focusing a little bit more on some of those diversity issues and, kind of challenges that might affect communities other than just the white.
Because that sounds remarkably low. Of course, that's overall. When you go to Myers Park High School, the reverse is true. So but still, it's a remarkably low number. UNC Charlotte held commencement ceremonies in the last week in the shadow of that tragic shooting on campus of 6 students, 2 of whom lost their lives. How were those students who lost their lives commemorated at these ceremonies?
Anonymous donors are providing UNC Charlotte with $1 million scholarships in both of their names.
And some good news has emerged from that tragedy, if there is any good news to come from things like this. Drew Piscaro, who was wounded in that shooting, and after 13 days in the hospital, posted a video of his first steps without a walker. He tweeted, "Update, day 13, took my first steps without a walker today, so I felt the need to share it with everyone."
He just seems like such an awesome kid, and it's so cool to see all the Panthers players and other professional athletes visiting him in the hospital. He actually posted yesterday or a couple days ago that he had his first real meal, a grilled cheese sandwich.
Wow.
Dreams are made of.
Yes.
Well, if you haven't eaten good food in the
right.
Yes, indeed. Charlotte's housing market's been tight for a very long time. Fewer homes have gone on sale. Fewer homes are being built. Population continues to grow. That tightens the market. But after declining for 11 months, year-over-year sales were essentially flat last month. And that's good news? How is that a sign of improvement, Katie?
1 month does not a trend make, and I think that any economist or professor, anyone who watches the housing market can tell you that. But in Charlotte, it's been a pretty, I think anyone trying to buy a house can attest to the fact that it's a very tight market right now.
You report, I think the Observer reported, 72% of homes are now selling below their original list price. At least that was the case in the first quarter.
I think, I couldn't begin to surmise what the entire situation is, but I think that there's been a lot of demand for those middle of the road kind of single family home starter houses in like the 300 to 400 range. People get pretty cocky when they start to try to sell their house. They ask too much. Maybe they have to lower the price. Who knows?
Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Observer, Nick Oxner from WBTV, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.